y'all here today as we're going to kick off with an addition to the 2019 Iowa Farm Bureau Economic Summit. And it's a pleasure for us to be able to continue this for one of our speakers who, with issues beyond his own control, was unable to make it to our June 28th event. So we're going to record this event for him to be able to provide a breakout session and be able to continue on through here. So this is a special event that'll be put out online for people to be able to view, and I'm appreciative for everybody who was here today to join us at this event. So extending back from the Economic Summit, we want to once again thank all of our sponsors who made a large portion of this event possible, obviously with the Iowa Farm Bureau organizing and providing the lion's share of that support. But we had Farm Credit Services of America. We had People's Company joining us, and our speaker is actually affiliated with People's Company. Bayer is one of our sponsors, Corteva, and then Iowa Bankers Association. So it was great to be able to have so much wonderful sponsorship out through there. And it was a great event. And for those who are listening on this recorded event, we would encourage you to consider future events we have online, as well as to find more information that's going to be available at the Spokesman Speaks podcast. So you can download the Spokesman Speaks podcast on your favorite iPhone or Android and download that app and then be able to listen to more information coming from the Spokesman Speaks podcast. So, but for today, we have Dr. Dave Muth coming in. Now, Dave is a PhD scientist engineer. So it's kind of interesting to have somebody come in with this kind of credential, but Dave is one of the, experts, if you will, at applying science to productivity on the ground and looking at the value of farmland, especially as he's located here in Iowa. And I'm just going to say it this way, like I call myself a Missouri farm boy, Dave's an Iowa farm boy. So it's a wonderful thing for us to be able to have Dave coming in to join us. He's actually, like I said, he's affiliated with People's Company, and so actually when we reached out to People's Company for getting somebody to come on to talk to us, Dave was the nominee. Now, I hope that meant that Dave was volunteering to do that, not just Dave was told you're going to do this, but we are very glad to have Dave with us here today. And we're going to talk about what's happening with land values, which is something obviously that's very important in today's agriculture, and we're very glad to have Dave with us. So would you please help me to welcome Dr. Dave Muth.
Thank you very much, sir. Well, good afternoon. Sam said special, right? He's setting expectations incorrectly here. We need to manage these things a little bit. But I'll give you my quick background. So I'm a North Central Iowa farm kid. I am a classic product of the 80s. Mom and Dad started the farm from scratch in 1980. That's a good choice, right? So it was tough and had jobs off the farm. And as many folks in that generation, I got sent off the farm to do something better. So I went off to college. I ended up getting trained up as a mechanical engineer, graduate work at Iowa State. I worked in advanced biofuels for a number of years. This was in the George Bush cellulosic ethanol kind of push. And we were building those systems and working on all of the supply chain back to even sustainability of production. And built out a handful of technologies, integrating some remote data resources, some precision ag technologies, and made a few realizations as we got down to the sub-acre level that ultimately I took into an ag tech company, founded a company called Ag Solver up in Ames in 2013. And we sold Ag Solver in the fall of 2017 after building out a few different apps and creating some market momentum. And as we've sort of moved on from that particular project, now we're looking at the land investment world. And so partnered up with Steve Brewer of People's Company with a sister company, Alternative Equity Advisors, and do quite a bit within the people's infrastructure also. So that's where we're coming from. And you'll kind of get that little bit of a tech data feel on what's going on. And what we're going to do is talk a little bit about Iowa and what's going on. But I want to bring in a little bit about what we're seeing across the country. And we really believe that this sort of pattern, there's a few trends that are going to start to impact and come into our state just a little bit more as we go forward. So just really quick, what People's Company is, think of it as a land transaction company. Okay, so we're touching all components of the land transaction, brokerage, management, appraisals, and then the investment side, we've built this sister entity to be able to help represent investors coming in to buy farmland. It's a national footprint, offices throughout Iowa, up in the Great Lakes, Pacific Northwest, and a couple of other new offices coming online across the country also. So we're really building the footprint out to be able to understand and work in all of the different kinds of production systems that we're seeing across the country. So a couple fun facts on Iowa. Now, for the folks in the room, these may not be, you might have them just sort of ingrained in you a little bit, but I like to hone people in on really what we're doing and what we have at our fingertips here. So almost 90,000 farms. Average farm size, still 434 acres, right? It feels like it's getting bigger. It's me. I farm. I have my own farming entity, an operation that's married up to the old family operation. So I'm in this category, right, that drags this down to where it is, as my dad would call them, fake farmers or part-time farmers. A lot of economic value, right? It's incredible. If we look at just across the country, we're second in the country in terms of cash receipts to California, okay? And what's interesting about this is these four states over here actually account for about a third of the agricultural cash receipts in the entire country, right? So there's a lot of economic value being created, and we all understand that. I like these graphics because they give us a little bit of spatial context on really what we're pulling off here. Okay, so we're about 1.5% of the area in the U.S. So that spatial context is being held. Iowa produces more grain than all of Canada, all right? We produce more soybeans than all of China, and these are incredible things, right? This is an incredible, incredibly productive system that we put in place. How do we do it? It's our land resource, and the hog production piece is one that's been really interesting, right? So a lot of us saw that vertical integration of the hog industries in the 90s, where it went from that farrow to finish that I grew up on to fairly integrated large-scale operations in about 5 years. It really transitioned fast. Right now, we produce more hogs than the next five states combined. Okay, and if we were our own country, we'd be third in the world behind China and the U.S., or in China and the U.S. in hog production. Okay, and it's our land resource that does this for us. Okay, it's about a $225 billion asset class. If you look at the Iowa State data and the surveys and what we're looking out there. A little bit of context on where that fits with other asset classes in Iowa. Commercial real estate in Iowa is about $37 billion. Residential, about $162 billion. We're more than those combined. Okay, our land resource, we're the Manhattan real estate of farmland. Okay, and this is actually a really powerful thing for us. And it actually creates some interesting dynamics in the investment space that we'll talk about just a little bit more also. Okay, so let's start thinking about land values and the factors that impact it. What we put up here, in Iowa, in a lot of ways, the equations aren't that complicated, right? What are we really, corn drives it, right? What are we getting for our corn? And then what's the cost of money, right? Because most of this land is going to be bought with some leverage behind it. And here we're tracking back to 2000 up through 2017, looking at the corn price on a calendar year basis, and then looking at the 10-year treasury rate as a proxy for our leverage rates, all right? And then, of course, the values as they trend upwards. This is some pretty incredible numbers. I mean, for me, the 2000s don't feel that long ago, right? And you get into 2008 and 9, and we're in the average land values in the low to mid $4,000 an acre range, and thinking, man, this is incredible buys, right? And then commodity prices ran, as we know, starting in 2010, up through the heyday in 2013, and land values went up very, very quickly with that. And then we haven't really come down nearly as much from a correction standpoint. So if we look at a few of these factors, and you look at 2017, 331 corn, 246 treasury rate, and about $7,300 an acre. We're not too far off of that. Of course, we've gotten a little bit of a run on corn values. But one of the things that's interesting is what's a corollary year historically that we can look at? And there isn't a perfect one. 2007 is interesting. Okay, we're at 337 corn, basically the same. Money was a little bit more expensive, but not terribly expensive, right? We're still in the range of what we'd consider good rates. And land values were under $4,000 an acre then. So there's a natural question here. Were we right then or are we right now? Okay? And that's sort of a complicated answer, and the system has sort of built itself around this particular question, and we know how to give an answer to this. All right, let's look at a little bit of a different view on this. Okay, this is a very explicit scenario. Let's say we've got 180 bushel per acre cornfield, and a pretty standard factor when you think of a cash rent relationship is the landlord's going to get about a third of the revenue. Okay, so if we look at what the corn price is, and then what that landowner cap rate, that annual cash return expectation is, we've got a little matrix put together that can back into the land values. All right, and we think about when we were up here at $6 a bushel and investors were wanting about a 4% cap rate and we're about $9,000 an acre, right? We all remember that. That was not all that long ago. So what happens when we come back into these threes and fours again? Why haven't we seen these prices come back into this range? Well, the answer is that this return expectation has shifted down. You can actually be back at $3 corn, and if you're only expecting a 2% cap rate, you're still at that same $9,000 an acre. That's a really important point, and we'll put a little bit more color around that as we go through. Okay, so let's think about the interest rate impact. So we're borrowing money. We've got leverage against this. Okay, a simple scenario again, $10,000 an acre, 4.5% return on a 10-year rate with a 20-year term, 60% LTV. This gets us to a principal and interest payment per acre of $461 an acre. Okay, so what we're doing down here is we're saying, well, that's got to be our payment. What happens to keep that payment to the land values as the rates go up? So at that 4.5% rate, and we see the $10,000 an acre value, as we raise this, we see at 6.5, now we're down 15% at $84.50 an acre. We get up to 7.5%, which, you know, we have to think at some point we're going to see a little bit of inflation in these rates. Okay, now we're all the way down at almost 22% decrease just from the cost of money. This is a pretty impactful piece of information in terms of where the land values start to make sense. Okay, so let's kind of play a couple of these things out and say scenario one is sort of a simple base case and apply a handful of these different factors to it. So $5 corn, our $180 yield, our 33.3% going to the landowner, so we're at our $300 cash rent, 3% return expectation, okay, this value at $10,000 and the 4.5% loan rate. We're going to drop the corn price a dollar, okay? We're going to say that the landowner is going to expect another 150 basis points of return, all right? And then we're going to say that the cost of money goes up 100 basis points. All of a sudden here, we get down to a financially rationalized land value of $4,900 an acre. None of these individual characteristics are very, very outlandish, right? These all sort of make sense. And what we step back and say is, how does this actually compute, understanding what we've seen? And we've been waiting for some corrections to start to come in, and we'll explain a little bit on why they haven't necessarily shown up here. Now, we spend quite a bit of energy understanding what's going on, right? This marketplace, there's a lot of movement. There's a few tech companies. There's a few different organizations working harder to create a more consolidated data resource around what's really happening with these transactions. These things are very helpful. We leverage the heck out of them. They're going to create a more efficient marketplace and a more rationalized marketplace over time. We're still putting quite a bit of energy just into collecting and aggregating and understanding data. 190-plus websites on a weekly basis. These metrics are a little aged. I'll admit, maybe a month, maybe 3, 4, 5 weeks old now. 634 listings. Only 158 fall into the what we'd call highly tillable category, right? 85% or more tillable. That's just 1.6 farms per county in the state. Okay, that's really, really important. supply is not particularly strong relative to demand in farmland. That's one of the reasons why we see quite a hold in prices. And then we've got 47 tracts that are currently being marketed to go onto public auction, which seems to be a fairly preferred method in a lot of ways to transact farmland in Iowa right now. Okay, so the famed dollars per CSR 2 point, right? This is the most rationalized sort of efficiency that's built into the Iowa land market. And we're seeing similar things show up in other states, but it doesn't quite feel the same as this dollar per CSR 2 point. And we can see CSR 2 certainly has been moved forward as a metric versus the original CSR with some additional factors. The folks at Iowa State working with NRCS kind of adding some depth to this, but it is a clear signal and a clear efficiency building into the market. Here's the trend going back to the beginning of 2016. We've seen some climbs, a little bit of a peak. We saw a drop through the end of 2017, early 2018, and then we've seen just a little bit of a tick up. This is through quarter one. We're down in, we're just over, we're 111, holding in that 111, 112 range in the quarter since. Need to get that data on there. But it hasn't moved a lot, right? This is kind of where we're at, and we're still seeing this trend. There's certain parts of the state where you'll see large deviations against this metric because productivity relative to the soil rating just seems to be very high, as an example. But this is a pretty good metric to be able to come in and quickly start to assess where a deal sits. Okay, so the other really important factor beyond supply that impacts how these price trends are moving is who's buying, all right? In Iowa, we're up in the 80% range is still being bought by farmers. That's why the cap rates go down so far. It's not an investor that's building a portfolio that needs that annual cash yield that the higher cap rate provides. It's still being driven by farmers. Okay, there's elements of that in the corporate farming laws that keep some of the institutional buyers from aggressively getting into the state. We still see some of the professional buyers working in the state, but this is really important. How might this change, right? There's a couple of things that we watch pretty closely because we think that a movement downward in this farmer-buyer line is going to start to signal some corrections in the market. Okay, we all know farm net income's down, right? I think a lot of folks have probably seen this chart in one way, shape, or form. And what's really interesting is if we look, this was still a forecast on 2018. I think it's basically buttoned down in this arena. We're all the way back to net income in that 2008 and 9 range. Okay, if we think about that in our personal lives, our net income versus our expenses and our lifestyle and how we're living falling back 10 years, that's difficult. That's incredibly difficult. Okay, and this is an interesting metric that I personally keep an eye on a fairly regular basis. This is called the Farm Sector Financial Ratios. It's by the Economic Research Service. It's put out, and it's representing the entire U.S. farm sector, right? So there's a lot of things lumped in there. The metric that I find interesting is working capital to gross revenues. Okay, what we're saying here is how much cash, liquid working capital, does the farm sector have relative to their annual revenue? Okay, and I think a lot of folks have heard, certainly the working capital within our operations has been really hit hard over the last 5 to 6 years. And a lot of the lenders have transitioned to paying very close attention to what's happening on that metric. If we go back to 2010, we're at 0.43. That is a really healthy system. So 43% of the annual gross revenue was available in liquid cash working capital. Okay, the forecast, and this has been reforecast 3 times, I think this is a final number. I have to check. It's time to go pull this again. 0.12 in 2018. That's getting stressed. Okay, the available cash as an instrument to keep farmers buying here is an important piece of the land value equation in Iowa going forward. Now, because supply is low, then we see that there's still enough farmers with the wherewithal to continue being the primary purchasers for a while. But we all know that we've got some demographic transitions happening too, right? So now if we can get supply, if we see supply starting to move a little bit, we see that liquid working capital among the farmer base is still low. Now we're creating a dynamic where we could start to see some corrections. These are all important pivot points. In the near term, we've thought we were on the cusp of some corrections and some things starting to come in. We haven't seen them materialize over the last year and a half, even though a lot of the fundamental economics would dictate that they should. These are some important metrics to keep an eye on to start to understand when that correction is happening a little bit. And I think I lost my ability to go forward. Can I go backward? Yeah, you bet. Yeah, it's amazing, right? So potentially, right? So when you look at that, you're sitting there and you're saying $225 billion asset class. I think the number was 83% of the land has no leverage against it. And you say we can very quickly capitalize at a 50% LTV. You're talking about, you know, $100 billion of cash that could be pulled out and put to work in various different forms and uses. Now it gets back into the ownership dynamics where we're looking at 60% of the land being owned by people that are 60 years or older, right? And I might be off a little bit on those, but it's generally in that category. Those aren't necessarily the folks that are looking to essentially leverage that equity into cash to move on. And what's the real interesting story within that question in my mind is how are we going to watch that transition? Okay. And we see a lot of different scenarios. One that's pretty common, overgeneralizing is always dangerous, but one that's pretty common is multiple siblings. One is trying to stay as an on-farm heir. Others may have spread across the country or maybe still in the state, but very focused on a professional career and those sorts of outcomes. And the on-farm can't quite capitalize a purchase. The other siblings aren't so connected to the land and would like to create the cash outcome. How's that going to work and how's that going to play out is probably the most interesting story, meaning does that amount of capital that's locked up in this land as this transition make its way back into farming, or is it moving out, right? So these are all really interesting questions that we don't have the answer to, but they're metrics that as you kind of keep an eye on what's going on and look at it, we're going to get some signals that we can move and react to just a little bit. Okay, so let's start to pull this into an investor perspective just a little bit more. And this is at the heart of this, right? So if we start to see a few of these things play out, supply increases, farmer working capital stays a little bit lean, and now there's new capital that all of a sudden says, hey, return rates are high enough that now I'm interested. Okay. What does that look like here a little bit? So just this price per CSR 2 point example, let's say we've got a nice solid 85 CSR 2 piece of ground. That's a 275 rent. This 2.7 cap rate, which is about where we're at, hits you at that $10,200 an acre range, okay, at the $120 a point. We've come down from that a little bit, but we're not too far down from that. When that investor's in there and they're saying they want that 4% return, we're at $68.75. That's a pretty swift correction. Okay, now nothing ever just jumps that quickly. That line will move at a pace that's yet to be determined, but we see where a lot of these fundamentals are driving us in that direction, and we anticipate that some of these corrective moves are going to be in there. There's certainly market pieces, right? Remember corn prices going back up, other elements in the system coming back up, generating more revenue, balancing some of these factors. But all things being equal, we think that the supply, the who's buying, okay, and their return expectations are going to be very big indicators moving forward on where we're going to see this. So I want to expand our perspective just a little bit. And we're seeing some things across the country that are going to have a pretty big impact, we believe, on how we're managing in Iowa. We kind of live in a bubble just a little bit. Our system's very well orchestrated. Occupancy rates, thinking about that Manhattan real estate example, 100%. There's no good tillable farmland that goes unfarmed in a given year, right? And it doesn't take a lot of work to find the next person who will pay a market level or above market level rent on a piece of ground that's available. Okay, let's look a little bit about what's happening here. So we've calculated based on some 2017 USDA data, this cap rate by state. So we're looking at their average land value and their average cash rent. And you see quite a bit of this, most of it is below this 3% line across here. The I states in here are all in the high twos, which is what we see when we're down in the weeds with the data on individual transactions also. There's a few of these that are popping up pretty high, 5% and higher. Pacific Northwest is Oregon and Washington. And we're getting into some of the permanent crops and some of those kinds of other production systems a little bit. As a rule, as the quality and stability increases, right, so a 100% occupancy rate, good farmland, it's always going to be productive barring specific circumstances, and management complexity decreases, hey, find a farmer quickly, sign them up to cash rent, they're going to do a good job, it's going to work, then the cap rate expectations tend to adjust down, right? Because it becomes a bond, right? They're just clipping coupons every year, essentially, with that cash rent check, and it's going to continue to work. So actual performance in a couple of regions right now, Midwest is below 3 caps. The Delta is below 4 caps. And the Pacific Northwest, you do see that up above the 5s a little bit. When we look at what the investors that are out there with very explicit portfolio agendas in farmland, they want to be at a 4% plus in the Midwest. They want to be at a 5% plus in the Delta. And they want to be at a 6% plus in the Pacific Northwest. That's a disconnect, right? And how do we start to bridge some of those gaps? That's going to be where we look at a few themes that we've got here. First, let's look at how they're doing it now from just a raw, simple numbers standpoint. Okay, so up here you've got your baseline land. Let's call it that 8750, 250 cash rent, 2.8 cap rate. Okay, this is right in the parameters of reality right now. Well, one way you can do it is you can buy low. All right? So if they can get the land bought at $6,250 and hold that sustainable cash rent, then they can get to their 4% return. That is a difficult investment strategy to deploy, having to buy land at 25 or 30% below market. Right? You'll find your deals, but that's not a portfolio strategy. The thing that we're seeing happen more is, well, let's see if we can get somebody to pay us more. So they're buying at the $8,750 and they're saying, well, can I get a $350 cash rent to get me to that 4% return? And they're getting it, right? And we all know about these stories, and there's some highly publicized downturns on large-scale farmers where they haven't been able to continue cash flowing. And here's the reason. Here's just a simple corn cash flow, all right? You get to, and this is on some prices that we would have seen a few months ago versus where we're at now, $830 to actually farm it with that $250 land expense, 210 yield, $4, net income of 10 bucks an acre, which is a really depressing return as a farmer. But it's kind of a reality that we faced. When we put that $350 cash rent in there, that's the only thing that's changing, right? The land's the same. The productive capacity is the same. That's almost $100. It's a $90 an acre loss. Okay, so this works because they're able to find the next farmer that's willing to sign up, but it's not a sustainable strategy over the long term. So what are the opportunities? What is the market showing us? What are we seeing happening in a few regions where we're starting to understand how to create more value and tie some of these things together? There's two really interesting themes that are popping out, and they're driving a lot of what we do right now. One is there is a new sort of fresh movement on consumers wanting to connect with their food. Okay, that's emerging through a few different pathways. This notion of sustainable sourcing is certainly a big part of that. It's not entirely clear how the long-term value add is going to show up with that particular component, but we are seeing some specific scenarios within the marketplace where that value add is there. Organics is a big deal. Organics, the market has shown where the value's at. We have a little bit of rationalization in terms of being able to plan and put systems together around it. Traceability, right? And then there's a disaggregation of the supply chain that's happening a little bit. And this is where we're in a bubble. Our commodities continue to flow just as they always have. You move into other regions. Pacific Northwest is a great example. These direct-to-consumer or very disaggregated and fairly lean supply chains are very real, and they're continuing to emerge in a lot of different ways. And it's an opportunity as a farmer that can take advantage. The other piece is we're seeing what we're calling an evolving capitalization of operations. This, for some folks, gets a little uncomfortable, right? Because it's kind of like breaking the chain potentially of farmer as an independent business owner that is getting conventional financing and running their operation. We view it as a good thing, right? Because here's the reality. There's a lot of farmers out there at the generation that's managing several thousand acres now that these are big businesses, right? Million, $2 million, $3 million a year moving through. And the things that made those farmers great at building that up are now different kinds of roles. They're labor roles. They're roles that you have to fill with employees. And the notion of being able to partner on the capital side with people that can supplement the right skill sets, thinking about the marketing, thinking about some of the other business elements, actually can create a lot of strength in these operations. And it doesn't cut out the conventional capitalization, the conventional debt operating, et cetera, that's in the market. It's just a little bit of an evolution in the business. All right, let's look at sustainability just a little bit more. So this graphic right here represents all of, you might not be able to see it, it's all the different brands we buy, okay? Grocery stores, convenience stores, et cetera, all these different packaged goods brands that we buy, controlled globally by 10 companies, okay? They even have competing brands within some of these same boxes that come in, same product, but at different price points, right? That kind of thing. They've all built corporate sustainability reports, CSR reports. You'll hear that a lot. To respond to the consumer demand to understand how their sourcing is having environmental impacts. The General Mills example is an interesting one here, and it's aged now. They were early with their report, but top 10 raw ingredients represent 50% of the purchases. Their goal is 100% sustainable sourcing by 2020. I don't know what that means. And they've been working hard to figure that out, right? And that means money is really moving into the supply chain based on this evolving notion of documenting what sustainability is. There are value adds here. And then we're also seeing consumers start to move to more of these direct pathways. These three, I'll give examples on as we get to the end here. Puget Consumer Cooperative up in the Pacific Northwest, Braggadocio Organic Rice down in the Boot Heel of Missouri, Bob's Red Mill, you can see his products, flours and various other milled grains in Hy-Vee as an example. And I'll talk a little bit about that with our examples. Organic. Okay, so we're moving aggressively in the organic space. And one of the key questions is how long does the premium stay, right? Production's going to go up, right? We're going to start to produce more. That gap will close. It's much more difficult. All of those kinds of moving parts. Well, here's what we've looked at, right? Consumption's moving up at a much faster pace than production in the U.S. Okay, 60% of our organic corn, 80% of our organic soybeans are imported. Okay? These are the soybeans from countries like Paraguay and Serbia and Turkey and Kazakhstan and India and Ethiopia. Can they produce organic soybeans better than we can? I would have a hard time believing that's true. The reality is that some unknown but very large percentage of these organic feed grains that are imported are fraudulent. Okay? We've heard numbers from Turkey where the actual certified acres would have to produce 600 plus bushel corn to actually meet what's imported. And right now it's very hard from a regulatory standpoint to really crack down on this because the organic protein industry in the U.S. would suffer pretty dramatically. All right? And so we have room. We have room to actually aggressively grow our organic acres. We have the source of the organic fertility, and we have an economic case to be able to start to get that done. What we really need, though, is the ability to overcome these challenges that are out there. Certification is a challenge, but it's a process, right? You can adapt to it. We can all adapt to it. There's service providers that are starting to help us on that front. Agronomic and operational knowledge. There's a couple of companies emerging that are helping to disperse this knowledge and helping to get systems set up more and more. We're working aggressively to kind of pull them into our system. Financing is tough. Transition, you're going to lose money. There's no way around it. We go back to the farmer already working capital strapped. Okay. Hey, I want to transition to organic in order to improve my net income. Well, wait a minute. So you're going to go in the hole more for a couple of years in the process of getting there. We need some structured financing that can help be responsive to this. And the marketing side, I think we've seen the most movement here in creating more rationalized and available marketplaces for these organic feed grains in particular. Certainly the direct-to-consumer foods are emerging pretty quickly. But these elements, we're working hard to put together as a package that we can bring to investors and start to build some programs out that are responsive to this. Now, let's think a little bit more about this notion of the partnership between the capital versus just the business relationship from a farming standpoint. Okay, one of the things that if you're an investor, when you think about managing directly, you run into the problems of it's extra exposure, right? Because you're going to have your own cash in the operations, not just deployed in the land. And then the management complexity side. Like we work with some folks that sit in a high rise in New York and they're investing, they're a family office and they're investing money for a Forbes 400 billionaire managing his portfolio that goes into all of these different pathways. They don't want the management complexity, right? And so we've worked hard on building an operating platform where we can actually be profitable for our own business and be able to improve returns for these clients in doing it. And we need the right partnerships with the farmers. This is not displacing farmers. This is creating the right partnerships where we can add skill sets. We can have dedicated resources finding better markets. We can have dedicated resources helping with the business planning. We can have more fluid capitalization that can be responsive to their needs. And then what's beautiful about this, we have incredible data resources in the U.S., so that we can actually do a pretty darn good job building these business plans purely with analytics in a remote sense. And I'll talk a little bit more about that as we go here too. Okay, so one of the things that we wanted to look at with the analytics, and this is for some folks a little bit of an uncomfortable note, but it's an important business planning piece. Okay, ag land is the only investment-grade asset in the world, U.S. farmland, only investment-grade asset in the world that has a federally subsidized program that creates a minimum revenue guarantee. This is an incredibly powerful tool when you're thinking about it from an investment standpoint. And we can come in and we can actually characterize exposure levels exactly and precisely down to a county and a field basis all the way across the country. And then we have the ability to be able to come in and look just with remote data. How profitable are we down on a sub-acre level within a field? Okay, and we start to put these things together, and it creates business planning that can really support the emergence here. So when we look at these analytics, here's some things that we can actually start to just characterize remotely. Obviously, the revenue piece. Okay, soil, climate, topography, water, pest pressures, organic grain, that's starting to emerge. All of these data resources are available. We can put this stuff together pretty easily. And this isn't just us, right? There's a lot of folks out there working on this that are rationalizing the marketplace. Here's an interesting little point on this, a very simple example. Okay, what you're looking at with this map is organic tea yields, right? Tea yields are the RMA approved yield for a crop in a county. So the risk management agency assigns a tea yield for every crop in every county, okay, which is sort of that baseline insurance. Okay. Now, a farmer that's operated in that county will carry their own what they call APH, actual production history, that will overwrite the tea yield. But in a new system or a new scenario, this is the approved yield. Okay, and we're relating the organic tea yields for corn to the conventional tea yields for corn. This map looks funny, right? So we're sitting here in Iowa, and this whole state of Illinois looks a little different. Whole state of Nebraska looks a little different. Kansas looks a little bit different. Well, this is an actuarial exercise, and there's just simply not enough actuarial data around actual organic production in order to be able to do this. So RMA has picked a factor. And it's a factor that's set by state. Iowa is 0.6. The organic tea yield is 0.6 of the conventional tea yield on a county basis. Illinois, it's 0.65. I don't know why. There are 330 counties where the organic tea yield is 100% of the conventional tea yield. So I can come in there as a new farmer, and I can ensure the same yield at three times the price of my commodity. Okay, this is you never want to build an investment strategy around an insurance play, but this is a great tool for being able to help mitigate risk and create some upside in starting to work through these different equations. And we've bought some land down in this region that's organic, that we're converting organic based on some of these things driving it. This is all at our fingertips, right? These are business planning exercises that we can go through. So if you look at our investment portfolio, we're really focused on direct ownership, and we use all of these tools to be able to create the portfolio strategies, do the diligence, build the operating plans, and then we're playing heavily in the organic, regenerative, and the sustainable sourcing arenas. The reason I put this up is not so much about what we're doing, but as a reflection of, hey, we're putting to work what we're seeing out there. And let me show you just a couple examples quick. We're down to just 2 minutes here. I want to show you some organic transitions, some direct operations, and then this notion of business planning. This is a beautiful asset up in the Pacific Northwest. It's right across the border from Walla Walla, Washington. Okay, 3,000 acres of organic. Okay, what these farmers have done, brothers that have farmed it since 1976, went organic before it was cool, back in the early 2000s, okay, they have created huge value-added market relationships. Bob's Red Mill, that's where this comes in. Bob's Red Mill is paying these guys $21 a bushel for their organic corn. They're selling their wheat for over $23 a bushel into these direct-to-consumer pathways where there's still margin for everybody. And by the way, they're getting 200 bushel corn, and they're getting 85 to 90 bushel wheat, right? And we start to stretch through this. And what is amazing about this asset is these folks really struggled through their organic transition. They're getting close to retirement, and we're bringing an investor in that can recapitalize this operation. We can improve efficiency. We can add some more water management. We can upgrade equipment, lots of things that all of a sudden create incredible outcomes. And by the way, on this farm, if we grow organic Walla Walla sweet onions, we can guarantee, through the crop insurance program, $11,600 an acre in revenue. That is our minimum revenue. So you better believe there's going to be some onions on a couple hundred acres in this farm. Okay, so this is our Delta farm. Here's what's amazing about this. It's falling into a rice portfolio, an organic rice portfolio. Braggadocia organic rice, Boot Heel, Missouri, Steve McCaskill. Different story, a lot of the same themes as the other farm we showed you went organic before it was cool. His biggest organic rice customer is Chipotle Restaurant. Okay, 2 million pounds a year in a radius around Memphis. Goes up through St. Louis, I think maybe even touching Kansas City now. Chipotle wants to go 100% organic with their rice, 90 million pounds a year. We don't even know if there's that much produced, right? So what we're working on is creating the right partnership between the farmer with the know-how, with the processing capability, and the investors that can bring the land resources in order to actually build this out to be responsive to the market. It's a very profitable system. And with that, I think we'll move to some questions.
For this session. So one of the first questions that we'll have, and let's get back into Iowa, specific out through here, and we're talking about land values, and you talked a lot about some of the factors out through there, but when you see the distribution across the state of Iowa, and we can talk about, you know, CSR2, we can talk about all these other, but just geographic distribution in the state of Iowa, what do you see for trends for land values across the state and different regions in the state?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and there are some systems, right, that are in place in various parts of the state that are driving some really interesting outcomes. So up in the Northwest, there's some major drivers with the animal production where continuing to get access to land for the manure, right, and the interaction between the manure and the land resource is creating value adds where land values are continuing to drive. It's highly productive. Certainly they're not fighting productivity, but we're seeing some really high values in some of those systems in the Northwest. Up in the Northeast part of the state, this is where you see some really high dollar per CSR 2-point kinds of numbers come out. And the reason is you have some lower quality per the CSR 2 rating soils that are still incredibly productive, right, that are matching other places in terms of their productivity. You see a lot of variability south of I-80, generally speaking, and that matches the land, right? So there's still a lot of bottom areas that are highly productive, and then there's a lot of farms that have issues, right? They're not as productive because of topography, soil, long-term erosion, some of those kinds of constraints. When you look at the Des Moines lobe, it's pretty consistent, right? And it's continuing to drive through. You are seeing places where you get hog manure, right? Hog manure is a major driver. You're seeing added value, right? And that's because from a farmer cash flow perspective, you can pay a little bit more on a lease if you have a significant fertility source through your hog manure. And that translates into a little bit higher value in the land. And that we're seeing that as a little bit of a differentiating factor.
If you were to look at some of the changes in land values, biggest change up or down for some of these, and we talked, you know, obviously about some of the investors and what those cap rates are, but if you were to think about high-quality farm ground, low-quality farm ground, which one has the biggest opportunity to move?
Yeah, so the high-quality farm ground, because supply is low overall, the high-quality stuff is holding price. You still hear about those five-figure sales, 10,000, 11,000, even an occasional 12,000 an acre. So that top tier on quality is still attracting those buyers that are capitalized well enough to be able to get into that land. They're competing, they're willing to pay, and they're still buying it. When you move into that mid-tier and lower tier, that's where we've actually seen some corrections start to happen. And we're just not getting as much interest. All generalizations that you have to be careful about, right? Because certainly you can go find a scenario and a situation that would counter that point. But as a general trend, high quality is holding pretty well, and it's those lower tiers that we're seeing some corrections first.
Any questions from the audience?
Farmers buy this land, you said over 80%. Have you ever done any studies about how local those farmers are? Because my theory is that 80 only comes up in one generation, and I've always wanted it, and it fits well. Is it local farmers? Any comments?
Yeah. So I don't know how many times I've heard from my dad that the farm across the fence comes for sale once in your lifetime, right? And that's why the auction works, right? Is there's enough of that going on. So in terms of really in-depth analytics around that, we have not done it. So just sort of an intuitive feel of what's going on. I think that's largely true. We are seeing where the buyer pool that can be competitive, particularly when you get into that upper range of quality, has leaned out a little bit, right? That's back to that working capital issue. So you might see a little bit more distance start to build out. And some of the farmers that are going to farm it, they're also looking at it as part of their portfolio as they're thinking about retiring and moving into the next phase. So I think it's generally true, but I also think that we're seeing a little bit more movement in terms of how far people are willing to go.
Any more questions? If not, I'm going to ask you one more. Yeah. So you brought up the fact about some of these relationships, looking at some of these, whether it be a processor or a consumer packaged good firm coming in, and they're looking for people, and you mentioned the organic side of that and some of those values. What do you see in your experience and what you've been able to view from the industry, the opportunity to build more and closer those relationships that could potentially not just help those who are looking at investing in farmland, but those who already own that farmland right now?
This is really important. This is really important. And it's honestly, if we look at sort of the operating segment of farmland owners, it's not our strength necessarily, right? It's not something that we've built a lot of capacity. Again, overgeneralizing, we've taken advantage of the fact that we have these beautiful commodity networks and availability of markets over time. We see that the farmers and the operator owners that are going to be most competitive over this next sort of segment of time are the ones that are going to be able to create these connections, that they're going to be able to find the pathways that generate a little bit of differentiated value for the commodities that they're producing. And honestly, and this is one of the really hard things in Iowa, that look at their land and that capacity with a little bit more diversity in the production system, right? There's absolutely an opportunity for us to think beyond our corn and soybeans a little bit in being able to create a little bit of differentiated value. And these systems, you have lots of challenges. You have labor, you have know-how, you have access to markets, all of these sorts of components, but there are absolutely opportunities that can fit within the skill sets and within the capability of our operations, and we have the resource in terms of the land quality, the rainfall, et cetera, to be able to create some value-added add-ons within our existing operations. We think this is going to be a major differentiator over the next 10-plus years as consumers continue to pay more. One note that's really interesting on this. So we've gotten the question before, how much are consumers really willing to continue to pay more for the food, right? And let's hold constant that they have the expendable income, right? Because there's obviously things that can happen that chew up people's expendable income. We don't think we've hit the capacity, right? And it's a little bit like when oil prices ran up. And OPEC said, wow, at what point are we going to be so expensive that Americans are going to stop driving? And they found out that our capacity to pay is way higher than they would have thought. And what we see on the food side is we're still, even on our organic, high-value, natural, regenerative types of products, lower percentage of our income than most of the world, of the first world, in terms of how much we're spending on food. We think there's actually more room there, and it's just making that connection with that consumer in a way where we have all of the right parts together from the production through that endpoint. And the folks that are able to take advantage of that and find the right partnerships through the supply chain are going to have a differentiated value.
When we started to talk about some of the alternative crops, the third crop, such as we've looked at industrial hemp and those other aspects, it may be that the third crop isn't necessarily a different crop. It's a different way of marketing that crop into a different system.
That could absolutely be an opportunity, no doubt about it.
Yep, I appreciate that. Would you all please join me in thanking Dave for presenting here today?
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And while this session is going to be posted onto the iowafarmbureau.com website, we would encourage people again to go to the Spokesman Speaks podcast to learn more about the 2019 Iowa Farm Bureau Economic Summit. So again, thank you very much, Dave. We appreciate having you here. Thank you.
Thank you much.